Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers.
My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm the host of this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. So in today's episode of this podcast, we're going to talk about six of the key updates from the annual meeting of the European Alliance of Associations for Rheumatology, better known as EULAR 2023, which was held this year in Milan, Italy, from the 31st of May to the 3rd of June 2023. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
I'm going to start off with a story about the novel non-antibody fusion protein, which is effective in Sjögren's syndrome. So this was the ALIS trial. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's the phase 2 trial. It's of dazodalibep, which led to a significant reduction in the symptom burden in participants with Sjögren's syndrome. And these results really supported further development of this particular drug in phase 3 trials. This was one of the late-breaking sessions. Professor Eugene William St. Clair from Duke University Medical Center in North Carolina pointed out that a substantial part of patients with Sjögren's suffer from an unacceptable symptomatic burden, which equals to a score on the EULAR's Sjögren's Syndrome Patient Reported Index, or the ESSPRI, of greater than or equal to 5. And there's limited extraglandular organ involvement as well. The so-called ESSPRI focuses on the symptoms of dryness, fatigue, and pain, and moreover, these participants actually have been largely excluded from recent therapeutic trials, which only enrolled patients with a moderate to high systemic disease activity. Dazodalibep, it's a novel non-antibody fusion protein that acts as an antagonist of CD40L. Thus, it inhibits co-stimulatory signals between immune cells, including T-cells, B-cells, and antigen-presenting cells. And the drug was assessed in the randomized double-blind placebo-controlled parallel study called ALIS in two different populations of adults with Sjögren's syndrome. And this was presented by Dr. Chiara Baldini from the University of Pisa, Italy. And she presented the studies of a population 2, which was 109 patients, defining those participants with an unacceptable symptom burden and limited systemic disease activity. So participants in this group were randomized 1-to-1 to placebo or dazodalibep, and 102 completed the study of those 109 patients, which is pretty good, right? So at day 169, a statistically significant higher change in the so-called ESSPRI's total score, which was the primary endpoint, and the participants that were treated with dazodalibep was observed, and that was compared with the placebo control arm, and there was a reduction in 1.80 points in the scale in the dazodalibep arm, and that was significant. Similar results were observed for the three individual domains of ESSPRI, so that was dryness, fatigue, and pain. And Dr. Baldini, the presenter, said, quote, "The study was not powered for secondary outcomes, but despite this, we saw significant reduction in the fatigue score and a numerical decrease in the other secondary endpoints." The drug was also relatively well tolerated, with the most frequently reported adverse events occurring in greater than 5% of treated subjects were COVID-19, nasopharyngitis, anemia, and diarrhea. Larger clinical trials are now warranted to confirm the clinical efficacy as well as the safety of dazodalibep in this subgroup of patients with Sjögren's syndrome, and we're very interested in following this up in the future. And now we're going to talk about rheumatoid arthritis for a few minutes and the HUNT study results, which looked at a large population, and it looked at rheumatoid arthritis, or RA, and how it might be associated with increased risk of major osteoporotic features, or MOF, which they called it, compared with patients without rheumatoid arthritis. And they found that rheumatoid arthritis patients had a higher association with MOFs, or major osteoporotic fractures, but they also saw that patients treated with biological disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, or DMARDs, showed no association with these major osteoporotic events. So let's go back a step. Compared to the general population, the rheumatoid arthritis patients have reduced bone mineral density and increased fracture risk. We know that. Although bone-sparing properties for DMARDs, or biological DMARDs, have been demonstrated, the effect of different types of DMARDs on reducing fracture risk hasn't really been explored in great detail. And so to answer this question, Dr. Inge Bjørg Tronstad from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Norway performed the Trøndelag Health Study, which is shortened to HUNT, which was a population-based longitudinal study looking at 96,354 participants who were classified based on whether or not they had rheumatoid arthritis according to existing patient records or per international classification of disease codes, and that was ICD-9 and 10, and the American College of Rheumatology European League Against Rheumatism criteria. Disease status was registered at baseline, and it was updated if RA was diagnosed later. Accordingly, 1,033 patients had RA, and that was a mean age of 46.3 years, a little bit more than half, 53% were women, and 95,321 did not, so pretty similar levels. Of the former, 401 were diagnosed before inclusion in the study, and 632 were diagnosed during follow-up. So any MOFs diagnosed were also recorded, as well as the use of DMARDs. And Dr. Tronstad classified patients into three groups. There were 57 patients who had never used DMARDs, so they were called the never DMARDs. The 727 patients, so a lot more, using conventional synthetic DMARDs only, and there were 230 patients who had never used biological DMARDs. Participants were followed up until the first MOF, or death, or emigration, or end of follow-up in 2021. Dr. Tronstad revealed that the patients with rheumatoid arthritis, regardless of treatment, had an almost 50% increased risk of MOF compared with patients without rheumatoid arthritis, with a hazard ratio of 1.44. Additionally, the incidence rates of MOF per 1,000 person years were higher in rheumatoid arthritis overall and in all DMARD treatment groups compared with non-rheumatoid arthritis patients. After Cox regression analyses adjusted for age, sex, and smoking status, it was found that across the three treatment groups, people who had never taken DMARDs had the highest risk of MOF with a hazard ratio of 2.05, followed by the synthetic DMARD group, so that's a hazard ratio of 1.5, and in contrast, treatment with biological DMARDs did not significantly correlate with the incidence of MOF, and that was a hazard ratio of 1.03. That data is pretty strong, actually, I think. The authors concluded that even though rheumatoid arthritis is associated with MOF, it is encouraging that those individuals treated with BDMARDs had no association with MOF, and this should be considered in the future treatment regimens and the guidelines, ultimately, for rheumatoid arthritis patients. Interesting stuff. The HUNT study, that was called. Next, we have a Chinese trial looking at selective JAK1 or TYK2 inhibition and those possible ways of overcoming tofacitinib resistance in rheumatoid arthritis. This was a presentation by Professor Xiaofeng Zheng from Peking Union Medical College Hospital in China, and they pointed out that not many treatment options are available for difficult-to-treat patients with rheumatoid arthritis, and that is defined per the EULAR criteria as those who failed greater than or equal to two targeted treatments. Both cytokine signaling by JAK1 and those regulated by TYK2, including the IL-17 and IL-23 pathways, are involved in rheumatoid arthritis pathogenesis. We know that by now. And this was the rationale to find out whether TLL-018, which was an investigative, highly selective, dual JAK1-TYK2 inhibitor, could overcome resistance to JAK1 selective inhibitors. So the participants in the study with active rheumatoid arthritis and inadequate response or intolerance to methotrexate were randomized to receive either tofacitinib 5 mg daily or this novel investigative drug called TLL-018 in different dose regimens. So they had 10 mg, 20 mg, or 30 mg. The primary study endpoint was the percentage of participants who achieved ACR 50 at week 12. In addition, the percentage of participants who achieved ACR 20, 70, and full remission, so a disease activity score of less than or equal to 2.6, were assessed as secondary endpoints. At week 12, 65.4% of participants treated with TLL-018, so that's the new drug, at 20 milligrams, and 72% of those treated with TLL-018 at 30 milligrams, so those are the two higher doses, achieved ACR 50 compared with 41.7 patients treated with tofacitinib, and that was a p-value that was significant for both comparisons. In addition, the agent was also superior to placebo in secondary endpoints. And Professor Zhang commented that, quote, 17% of patients treated with tofacitinib compared with greater than 30% treated with a new compound achieved remission. So the TLL018 compound in the two highest doses achieved an ACR50 response of greater than 66% independent of previous treatment, so whether it was methotrexate only or a biological drug or a prior type 2 inhibitor. And the agent was also relatively well tolerated, with the most frequently reported adverse events being infections, in particular herpes zoster, elevations of gamma-glutamyl transferase, and hypertriglyceridemia. Professor Zhang said, quote, interestingly, the middle dose group had more adverse events than the high dose groups, and lipid changes occurred in the first 4 weeks, and at that point they stabilized. Professor Zhang concluded that the TLL018 20 mg can overcome resistance to tofacitinib and may be a valuable treatment option for difficult-to-treat rheumatoid arthritis. That was a late-breaking abstract. Fascinating stuff. There was a breakthrough in patients with refractory gout. That's an old disease with some new approaches. And this was looking at novel two-component infusion therapy to control serum urate levels. These were about the two similarly designed DISSOLVE 1 and DISSOLVE 2 trials, in which about 50% of patients receiving infusions with this novel two-drug combo were able to get their serum urate concentrations under control. And with this agent, anti-drug antibody responses, usually limiting one of the use of uricase products, are hindered by nano-encapsulated rapamycin. This was a presentation by Professor Herbert Baraff from the Center of Rheumatology and Bone Research in Illinois, and he said during his presentation, quote, at the moment, there are hardly any options for gout patients with refractory disease, end quote. Uricase-based therapy is recommended for gout patients who have failed to achieve uric acid-lowering agents, but the anti-drug antibodies that come with that therapy, they can diminish their effectiveness, leading to high treatment failure rates. In the Phase 3 studies, the DISSOLVE studies, in DISSOLVE 1 and DISSOLVE 2, the efficacy and safety of the innovative approach of SEL-212 as a potential new uricase-based therapy, it was assessed. And SEL-212 is a monthly two-component infusion therapy. It consists of an enzyme pegadricase that elicits a vigorous anti-drug antibody response, limiting its use as a monotherapy, and SEL-110, which is a tolerogenic nanoparticles containing rapamycin. SEL-110 is administered 30 minutes before the pegadricase, and it's been demonstrated to inhibit anti-pegadricase antibodies. Patients with symptomatic or refractory gout were randomized to receive either a high or a low dose of SEL-212 or placebo every 28 days for a total of 6 treatments. The primary endpoint was the percentage of participants achieving serum uric acid levels of less than or equal to 6 mg per deciliter for at least 80% of the 6th 28-day treatment period. Dr. Baraff emphasized that, quote, stringent stopping rules were implemented to minimize the risk of infusion-related adverse events, end quote. 265 participants were included in the study, and their demographic characteristics were balanced for age, BMI, and sex, but there were racial imbalances existing in both studies. Gout severity was numerically greater in the 153 patients included in the DISSOLVE 2, and the primary efficacy endpoint was met for both studies and doses. And in the DISSOLVE 1 study, 58% of participants in the high dose risk, so there are 38 patients there, and 48% in the low dose group, which was 37 patients, they responded to the treatment, which was highly significant. And likewise, the corresponding numbers in the DISSOLVE 2 trial were 46% in the high dose group and 40% in the low dose group. So those look really good, both highly significant and independent trials. The median change in serum uric acid levels indicates large reductions in at least half the patients, but also importantly, patients older than 50 years had similar response rates. So the treatment was relatively tolerable. The infusion reaction incidence was about 3.4% in the combined high dose groups. Professor Baraff concluded that the SEL-212 may potentially provide a new once monthly uricase-based treatment option for patients with refractory gout and maybe minimize the risk of refractory disease. At EULAR, there was a really interesting story also about systemic sclerosis, patients with precapillary hypertension, and how they may benefit specifically from targeted DMARDs. So it's not exactly immunosuppressive therapy per se, but treatment with targeted therapy demonstrated a significant protective effect on mortality or worsening in patients with systemic sclerosis and precapillary pulmonary hypertension as well. And these new results are based on registry data, randomized controlled trials, and are now suggested for further evaluation. A retrospective observational study was performed to gain insight into the possible benefit of targeted DMARDs on precapillary pulmonary hypertension complicating systemic sclerosis. Systemic sclerosis patients from the USTAR registry with data on their immunosuppressive therapy and results from a right heart catheter that fulfilled the hemodynamic criteria for precapillary pulmonary hypertension were included. And the analysis focused on death or a predefined worsening of the precapillary pulmonary hypertension as the outcome, comparing patients with or without immunosuppressants. It also took into account a wide variety of potentially confounding covariates, including risk stratification, among them gender, age, lung function, cardiac insufficiency markers, renal history, and medication levels. So there were 755 patients, and out of those, 82% were women, and the mean age was 63 years, and 29% had diffuse cutaneous systemic sclerosis and systemic sclerosis with precapillary pulmonary hypertension, and that was present over a mean of 11 years. Half of them were treated with immunosuppressants, and 94% of this group had greater than or one conventional synthetic DMARDs. After a follow-up of 2.9 years, 72% had either died or experienced an event of pulmonary worsening. And Dr. Cosimo Bruni, who presented this research at EULAR from the University Hospital of Zurich in Switzerland, described that, quote, these events were numerically higher in the immunosuppressant-exposed group, both for the combined outcome or the separate outcomes, by which he meant death or precapillary pulmonary hypertension. Primarily, the Cox regression modeling used, it failed to find significance in the effect of the immunosuppressants overall with no significant data. However, after stratification according to the type of treatment, targeted therapy demonstrated a significant effect on protection against the combined outcome of death or precapillary pulmonary hypertension worsening. As the presence or absence of interstitial lung disease might have influenced this result, a further categorization was performed that again yielded significance for targeted therapies, confirming that this effect was independent of ILD, of interstitial lung disease. Dr. Bruni recommended in his conclusion that, quote, now randomized clinical trials exploring targeted therapies should be designed using long-term morbidity and mortality outcomes to validate our results further and possibly improve care for our patients. Sounds like wise words. Talked about psoriatic arthritis yet, and there's plenty of information that was presented at EULAR as well. So this particular story was a retrospective Dutch study, and it investigated whether inflammation in patients with psoriatic arthritis may also be present in their vascular system. And to cut to the chase, the vascular inflammation was detected by 18 FDG PET CT using target to background ratio of the aorta, which has been found to be a reliable and reproducible measure. So this analysis included 75 psoriatic arthritis patients with an active peripheral arthritis from an ongoing clinical trial, and with a median age of 53, a median swollen joint count of 3, and a mean affected body surface of 1. This cohort was compared with a control group of 40 melanoma patients without distant metastasis, who neither had autoimmune disease nor were treated with checkpoint inhibitors. So this was presented by Dr. Nienke Kleinresink from the UMC Utrecht in the Netherlands, and she commented on the baseline characteristics with, quote, we found no difference in age, blood pressure, or gender, but patients with psoriatic arthritis had slightly higher BMI than the control group. Both groups comprised about 57% of men and about 15% had prior cardiovascular disease. The results showed significantly increased vascular inflammation in psoriatic arthritis patients versus controls, not only when evaluating the entire aorta, which was significant, but also in its 5 different subsegments. These findings remained significant after multivariate analysis that corrected for traditional cardiovascular risk factors, including age, gender, BMI, and mean arterial pressure. Dr. Klein-Resink also said, quote, "We also measured clinical features of disease activity such as tender joints count, swollen joints count, enthesitis index, BSA-affected psoriasis, and inflammation parameters, but these were not associated with vascular inflammation assessed on PET or CT." In her summary, she said that the study might confirm that in psoriatic arthritis, there is indeed systemic inflammation going on. Dr. Klein-Resink concluded that, quote, "It would be very interesting for future studies to assess the effect of psoriatic arthritis treatment on vascular inflammation," end quote. Seems like it makes a lot of sense to me. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast about the EULAR meeting of 2023 held in Milan, Italy. It was a great meeting, lots of great stuff, and we're excited for the field of rheumatology as a result. Have a great day, stay safe, and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.